This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here today for our interview episode with David Canfield.
Hello.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
David, we've missed you very much these past few weeks. I assume our listeners have as well. And you're back for a really great interview with a pretty major star of television at the moment. You caught up with Diego Luna, star of Andor. I think currently in production on Andor. He's really a globetrotter these days, right?
Very much in production. And an interview was completed while I was also... across the pond. So
look at you. Not in a galaxy far, far away.
Diego but... and I very aligned indeed. Yes.
So he's been acting for a really long time. People know him from all kinds of roles, but Andor has been really definitive in really fascinating ways for his career. How'd you guys get into that?
In a lot of different ways. I mean, he's an EP on the project, and one thing you learn about Diego Luna when you talk to him is he's someone who really passionately loves what he does and loves to take a certain degree of ownership over what he does. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about the many, many ways in which he contributes to the overall vision of this show, the way he really collaborates with Tony Gilroy from the inside out on the characterization, on the design. And as he says, playing a unique role among the producers and being able to take a step back as an actor and not be the producer who's in the room every day fighting over budgets and things like that and able to see what's working and not working. So really the guts of our conversation were about exactly how much he does on this show and how kind of thrilling that is for him.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because of the work he does on the show or many other factors, but Andor has really stood out among Disney Plus shows, among Star Wars shows. You've been one of the many evangelists being like, no, this show is like really something special. Even, you know, the Star Wars shows have been pretty good, but this one's really a level above.
Yeah, I think one real strength of his performance is in many ways, it's not a very dialogue heavy performance. A lot has to be communicated with his face, with the arc of this character who we know from Rogue One develops into this incredible revolutionary and this man who makes a great sacrifice. But in this show, we meet the kind of the birth of a hero who is a very flawed and kind of messy guy coming from a really challenging circumstances. And so being able to watch Diego chart that character's journey is really exciting. And hearing him talk about the ways in which he does that, I think is pretty interesting listening. So hopefully the listeners agree.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Diego Luna, I wanted to start by asking you where you are in the world right now, because you've been filming Andor for a minute, and this show is kind of an infamously globe-trotting experience for all of you. So where are you right now?
We're shooting in Valencia, Spain, which is one of the locations that we'll use on this season.
So over the course of shooting season two, how have you found all of the travel and all of the sort of getting back into it? And have you been able to spend much time with your family? I'm curious how that is compared to season one for you.
It's great in many, many ways. It's, basically, one thing that has changed and that I'm glad has changed is the chance we have to move. You know, I go back and forth to where my kids are or they come to me. Last season was shot The first season was shot in the worst moment of the pandemic, of the confinement, you know. So we were not allowed to travel. So for me, it was really important to be able to travel this time. And it's been different in many ways. You can tell, not just for me, obviously, but the show also, it's a show that we come from all around the world, you know. There is people from Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Italy, Spain. And this season has been more gentle, you know, for us to keep contact with our families and friends and life.
Yeah, I remember you'd expressed some anxiety upon first taking the job about taking you away from your life in a more major way than other projects. So now that you're approaching season two, does it feel weird now that it's kind of ending, just as it's gotten a little bit easier?
Well, the thing is, it's not ending. It's not even close.
True. Fair enough.
we started shooting in November, and all my life I've done theater and cinema, you know, and it's very different, a very different rhythm, and the times are very different, you know. Here, it seems to never end, you know. As I like saying, there is no time to celebrate, because when you finish something, you have to start something else right away. Like, I actually finished the first season when episode 6 was already out, you know, because I was doing all the Spanish dubbing for Latin America and the States. So, and it's exhausting, you know, in the best possible way also, because I'm part of a show I love. I am very proud of. I work with people I really, really admire. And today, people I love and that are my family, you know. But it is a full-time job. And that I can do just for a certain amount of time, you know. But the beauty of our show is that we know that it has a beginning and an end, you know.
Yes.
Since day one, we know this story ends when Rogue One starts. When we were shooting season one, we sat down and said, like, okay, how can we make sure we deliver, we get to the end, but also we do it, you know, before it's too late. Tony came up with this great idea of making like four blocks of this season, you know, so it's 4 years. The whole show, the idea was, this is 5 years before Rogue One, and the first season is 1 year. So now we're doing four blocks, and each block is a year, you know, before Rogue One. And therefore, in these 2 years and a half that this season will take us, we'll be able to get to Rogue One and finish what we started. And it's a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling because I'm very excited. I haven't lost that, you know. I can't wait for people to see this second season, because also we learned a lot from the first one. And it would be very disappointing not to have another chance.
Yes, I think we're all excited to see it. I'm fascinated by this idea of really this total immersion in a project. I mean, like you said, you film it, then you know promote it, then you go back to filming it. And the dubbing as well is really interesting to me. I'm not sure if you've done it before, but how did you find essentially playing a character in two languages and rediscovering him in Spanish like that?
It was tough, I have to say, you know, because obviously you don't have the time in Spanish that we had in English, you know, to reflect on what it said, to have so many chances to try and like basically the rhythm of looping, the rhythm of doing the dubbing is really fun, you know. It's done in weeks, you know. What you did in a year, suddenly you have to squeeze in 2 weeks of work. And it's very technical, because you have to match the mouth, you know. Right. Even though it's you, it's not you. And even though it's you, you're not on the moment. So it is very technical. I had to learn a lot. But I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And there's a chance to still play with it. But it is weird, because it's also a different team, you know. I'm working with with a new team. I'm working in Mexico with this great team, but that didn't happen to be on set, you know? So I become kind of a bridge between what happened that day and how can that be done in Spanish and work in Spanish. And there is so, in the writing of Tony Gilroy, it's very complicated, you know? There's so many layers. Things can mean so many things, you know? And there's so much that is not said, but that is implied, and it has to be done, you know? And obviously I get the scripts. I have a lot of time to reflect on them. I get to talk to Tony. Then we work with the directors on how we're going to do them. And then we go back and fix what needs to be fixed in post. That's the whole process in English. In Spanish, is you get the script and you're in front of a screen and the time is running, you know? So it's quite hectic, but I'm so glad I can do it because I wouldn't like basically Latin America to see this story without my voice. You know?
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
I also become very helpful in terms of telling them, no, wait a second. The line might mean this, but you have to remember this and that. And we were trying this other thing. So probably we have to adapt a lot, you know, what we're saying, because it's very dangerous to try to translate what's written in English, because many times you have to adapt it and change the whole sentence in order to say the same thing or imply the same thing, you know?
Right. It's pretty rare to have a one-to-one translation. So that, yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah. And it's not just me. It's Adria also doing her voice. And that's a special for us. And it's, I hope, special for the audience.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
All this speaks to the level of your involvement in the show. You've been acting for a long time. I know Tony Gilroy pitched this to you as you and him really in it together, and your credit as an executive producer. So what kind of creative involvement do you have in the show overall, and how has it evolved from that first conversation you had with him to now filming season two?
I guess I'm allowed to do what I always want to do, you know, and what I normally do without anyone asking for. This time is in paper, you know. We signed it, but I started producing and directing many years ago, and it's because as an actor, I'm used to theater, you know, where you're part of the whole thing, and in cinema, it is a very important role, the one actors play, obviously, but you come in when most is the side and just the last step has to be, you know, and I got tired of that. I got tired of getting there too late to actually have an input, to be part of it and to feel part of it in a bigger way. I really like understanding why things get to be what they are, you know. What happened before? What was the first idea that ended up evolving and becoming something else? I love owning what I do in that way, you know? And producing in a show like this can mean many things, you know, because everything is happening at the same time. You know, so sometimes I'm the eyes of on set, the eyes of Tony Gilroy, you know, well, because he's writing and I'm on set and I am living the everyday. And I can call him and say, like, look, this is happening. I'm feeling this. There's a lack of clarity here. Or like, man, this just happened. It's amazing. Take a look at it because that might inspire you for what you're writing, you know, stuff like that, like a bridge again between Tony that is working really hard now, not just in writing, but in for quite a while, writing and post-producing at the same time, mm-hmm. you know. Then we have Sana, who's on set every day. And I have a chance to see things from the day. I have time off, like no other producer in the show. You know, I can stay home and I can think about stuff and I can come back with ideas that probably by being there every day you don't see. But gladly, there's so much to do here that no one's stepping in on each other's toes. Is that the expression?
Yes.
Well, yeah, we complement each other very well. Then we have Kathleen Kennedy looking from the distance and making sure we have everything we need and all the freedom we need in order to do this. But she's always there when ideas are just ideas to give her opinion about it. You know, so it's difficult to define exactly what I do. You know, but I guess it's about having an opinion. When your opinion matters, you know, when there's time for that opinion to shape things, you know. And as an actor, you mostly, every time you come with an opinion or an idea, it's a little too late.
Yeah. Is there any instance or scene from the first season that you can recall where, you know, that opinion did matter and it did have an impact on the storytelling?
Yeah. I mean, I want to be very specific because I think it ruins the magic, but mm-hmm. I can tell you one thing is there is three teams, you know, we have three directors. One director does two blocks and the other two do one block, you know? Mm-hmm. So directors change and the perspective changes, you know, and as an actor, you're there, you know, through all these stages, you know, and I guess it's very helpful to be there to help them navigate the transition. Because at the end, we're doing the same story. You know, it's not that everyone is doing its own field. Even though each blog has a different perspective, directors also sometimes need to know what happened before in order to come in, you know. And that's a moment when as an actor, but producing at the same time, you can be very helpful for them to kind of, yeah, navigate and start to find the best way to have a relation with a train that is already moving, you know. It's not easy for directors to jump in a show that is going so fast and that it has so many layers and, you know, there's so many sticking parts. There is it's so complex that it's kind of cool to be there to remind them of that probably they're not aware of or that they're not seeing. I don't know. I also think it's very helpful to remind those who are designing or writing or just producing and making decisions and choices of the journey of actors, you know? And mm-hmm. and it's important when an actor is a producer because you can let them know stuff that is important. I'll tell you one. This is a good, I think, finally, I spoke ages to get to this point where I actually have something to say. So this Mexican kid does an amazing casting session with Tony, and Tony really likes him, and we decided we're gonna go with him for him to play casting when he's a kid. Right. And I really got involved in how to make it easier for him, you know. I guess not just being an actor that started as a kid, but being Mexican and understanding what it would mean for him. I kind of like talked to production about how to handle it and what could be needed for him on set. And I talked to the director that was going to receive him and asked him to do a few things that I thought could be very good and make him just more comfortable and relaxed. And I did get very, very, very much involved in that. If I wasn't a producer, I probably would have never raised my hand and say, like, guys, I think this kid needs this and that, you know? And I think it paid off. Like, he did an amazing job in very, very hard conditions.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, watching your performance in the show, you and your younger self have such a beautiful and rich symmetry in your performances. And so I would imagine that all that work you were able to do probably informed your performance as well in terms of capturing that full breadth of this character with him.
Yeah, yeah. And it was very important because we didn't shoot in order, you know? So
yeah,
it was very important to know what that was going to be like, you know, and what it meant, what exactly Tony was looking for and how that is. Yeah, because it's so important. It's like such a revelation, you know, and it explains so many things about this character. That piece of the story matters so much for everything else. And again, that's the beauty of being part of a show from the beginning, you know. I was there, I saw the designs, I talked to Luke, the production designer, I understood what kind of world he was imagining. I saw the references, I spoke to Tony a lot about it. I went with Michael Wilkinson, the costume designer, and saw the designs of everyone and the designs of that part of the story from the moment they were drawing, you know. Therefore, I had that there, and it's kind of like I had time to digest all of this and actually use it, you know, and have these very specific images in my head. I mean, as an actor, you always have to do that, but you end up doing that by yourself, you know. When we did Rogue One, I had to do that, but I did it myself, and this time, it's there. It's on the screen, you know, and it comes from the inspiration and designs of people that are part of this troupe, you know. So it doesn't compare to anything else, you know. We had that time here, and we've been working that hard on this one. The problem of season two, or the complicated, I mean, what makes season two complicated is that happened while we were promoting and putting season one out, you know? So it got a little more complicated. But at the same time, it's a beautiful feeling, you know, to go to work on season two after the experience of sharing the show and finding out that people care about it. It's a different feeling this time, you know. There's not so much fear as there was before.
Right. You're like, for example, spending your off day at the Producers Guild Awards, right?
Exactly. Exactly. or doing a lot of press, you know. Like, very few times I've been so proud to talk about what we do and so interested in also making sure others get the opportunity to watch what we've done. I am very, very proud also for the work of the team, you know. It's like I have so much to talk about. Obviously, yes, my experience, because I enjoyed it and I learned a lot and I am very proud, but I'm also very proud of what others have done in this show. Not just the cast, which is amazing, I would say, the work of Tony and Sana of getting all of these actors on board was spectacular. Couldn't be better. But it's the designers, it's the technicians, it's the team, the family, you know, that I am very proud of.
And if there's one thing that you learn about being in this world, a world as big as Star Wars, it's that secrecy is paramount until the thing is out there. So you kind of have to wait.
Yes, secrecy, it's important. But you know what? I think it's important to remind ourselves that that's the way it should be, you know?
Right.
I love the feeling of being in front of a screen and being surprised, you know? amused by what's in front of me. I grew up going to a cinema because it was the cinema that was near my house, and watching whatever was programmed there, and having to go through a story from beginning to end and then find out what I thought. Today, we get to the opening night already having an opinion, you know, of things. Like, I don't know. I think it's the magic of actually letting someone drive us through a story that we don't know, and really allow someone to take us, you know, to guide us, to introduce us to a world we're not in control of. But cinema is amazing. And today, yeah, we've seen so many trailers. We know the music. We read reviews. We, like, by the moment you're sitting in front of the screen, yes, you have an opinion. You already have an opinion. And I love what happens around Star Wars, you know, which is like, you gotta wait. You gotta wait because the magic of living it for the first time at the same time as others makes you part of something, you know? And I don't know, it feels special. It makes it feel unique, you know? I like that. I like that. And I think it's a good reminder. Also because we don't know what we're doing, you know? You know what you would like to do, you know? What you believe in. But then, the beauty of what we do also is that the accident happens, you know, on the way, and the collaboration is what brings the magic, and that just happens when it happens, you know. So it doesn't matter if you sit down and you say, like, I'm gonna do a film about this and that, and it's gonna play like this, and it'll be a mix of this and this other film, and yeah, they can tell you all of that. But then you go out there, you shoot, things happen, you have a realization, you suddenly understand things, then someone brings a color you didn't think could be part of it and ends being part of it. Like and then things happen. And with this story, we had in mind what we wanted to do, but we didn't know if we were gonna succeed or not, and that risk, it's beautiful. So it's important not to promise things, you know? Not too early, at least.
Yeah. I'll close by asking you to go back a little bit. It was interesting last fall to see you in this and Gael García Bernal, your Y Tu Mamá También co-star, doing Werewolf by Night. They both broke, you know, similarly new ground in their own respective universes. Both came out last fall, and both obviously represent new stages for both of you in your careers. Does some reflection come with that, from that little great movie you guys made to being in the biggest cinematic universes in the world?
Yeah, definitely. I keep saying that. I didn't think one thing would connect with the other. That is, if you ask me how did I get to where I am, I would blame a lot of that movie, you know? I remember when Gareth Edwards came to me for Rogue One and said, like, I would love to work with you. He mentioned it to Mamá También before anything else, you know? Hmm. And I was like, I really can't believe it, you know? And he was looking for something like that. He said to me, like, the tone of acting I'm looking for is that one, you know? We just happened to be part of the universe of Star Wars, but that is the level of reality I want, you know, of grounded performance. I'm looking for that simplicity also. And I was shocked. I was shocked when I heard that, because if you would have asked me back then, where do you think this film can take you? I would have never said this, you know, I would have never said, like, well, probably no, not at all. I think these were two different worlds, you know, and that one could not belong to the other. And the world is changing also, because probably I was right back then, right. But things are changing. you know. Things are changing, and audiences want to feel represented, and diversity is being represented in a different way. There's still somewhere to go, obviously, but things are changing, and I'm glad I'm part of this. And I'm always going to be thankful to that movie we shot in Mexico when we were 18 years old.
So now, Rebecca, let's hear your conversation with another star of a massive fantasy-based series from television from the last year. You talked to Morveth Clark about Lord of the Rings and venturing into Middle Earth.
Yeah, I was really curious how someone takes on such an iconic role and a role that was previously played by Cate Blanchett in the adult version. Like, how do you even handle something like that? And the interesting thing with her is she didn't know she was auditioning for Lord of the Rings when she auditioned. She didn't know she was going to play Galadriel until she got to New Zealand. So I think the key is you just go in totally blind.
Yeah, I mean, how much Middle Earth lore do you have to have or something to grab? I mean, what kind of research did she have to do to be able to grasp something like this? Or is it better to do the whole thing blind and just be your best elf self?
Well, she talks a lot about how she grew up with these books and these films. And, you know, she is Welsh. And for her family, this was a really important part of their lives. Like, she came home and watched these movies when she felt lonely at school. So she, like, had already done her homework, which I think was a huge advantage for her. But it also a lot of pressure because she understood how important this character is to so many people.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear all about it. Let's hear your conversation with Morveth Clark.
Today, I'm so excited to welcome Morveth Clark to the podcast. She stars in Amazon's The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, which is the hit series that has already debuted season one and has filmed season two. Is that right? Are you done filming? Where are you guys in the process right
now?
Hi.
Yeah, we are in the midst of filming season two. So it's okay. Kind of all stations go.
Yeah. I think I'm going to make you go back to the beginning and sort of tell me about the process for being cast, because I know this series was extremely secretive. So what was it like for you? Walk me through it.
Well, it started secretive in that I got an audition for my agent, and it was for this untitled Amazon project. And I kind of, all I knew about the character was that she'd kind of experienced some loss and had been to war at one point. And then I arrived at the audition, and I don't know if other people were told, or maybe I like just don't have any detective skills. But one of the actresses was next to me, and we started chatting, and she was like, "Can you believe we're auditioning for Lord of the Rings?" And I was like, "What? What?" And I had to kind of go into the bathroom and like kind of have a moment breathing in deeply, staring at myself, being like, you've got to turn up, Morveth. You've watched these films, you've read these books, you've been waiting for this, and kind of re-looked at everything I'd kind of prepared and tried to kind of make it suddenly be like I was in Middle Earth. And then I just started slowly meeting all the different people that were part of it. So the showrunners, producers, and then eventually had my final audition, which was a chemistry test with Charlie Vickers in Barcelona with all of J.A. Bayona's team. And we filmed it under an olive tree. And I was just, it was kind of a whole out-of-body experience. And then the next thing I knew, I was in New Zealand.
And so when did they tell you, or when did you realize you were playing Galadriel?
Oh, well, I didn't realize I was playing Galadriel until I was there. I kind of wasn't told. But I remember that before I found out I had the job, I was going to Toronto Film Festival for the first time. It was like a year where everything kind of went mental for me, really. And I was told that by the time I'd get off the plane, I'd have an answer. And then just kind of was just playing, do you know, the games that are on the back of like the seats? Mm-hmm. Just like frantically. Because all I could think of was that when I landed, I'd find something out. And so I found out that I had the job there. And then, yeah, I got to New Zealand, knew I was playing an elf, and was kind of trying to decipher what I was. And eventually I was taken to a room and told. And my immediate thought was, oh, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. Because it is strange to kind of find out that so kind of late in the game and when you're abroad. But then also the other side of that is, I think if I'd known for the whole time I was preparing to go out there, I also would have driven myself kind of crazy doing that as well. It's just a big thing to find out whenever you do. Because I'd loved the films. I'd loved Cate Blanchett. And like, yeah, it was a lot.
And so did that change how you prepared? I mean, was there any studying of Kate's performance? Or did you sort of decide you were going to make this your own?
I can't kind of unstudy those films because I watched them so obsessively and kind of had the books read to me and things. So I kind of felt that they were always just going to be there as a like wonderful inspiration to have some insight into what you're making. And it's quite nice sometimes to kind of feel that the character that I'm playing at this point kind of can't imagine that at one point she'll be at peace. And I think kind of lots of characters you're playing, their ultimate goal is to find that, but lots of them don't. So to know that she somewhat does is nice, because you get so protective of them, whoever you're playing, as you do it as well. I want her to be happy.
Yeah, it's like you got to read the end of the book first before you.
Which I actually do the opposite of. I don't finish books when I know they're not going to end how I want them to, which is one of my most toxic traits, apparently.
And so, I mean, you're sort of hinting at this, but obviously you were a fan of the books and the film, and that came from your family? Or tell me about where you were first sort of introduced to these stories.
Yeah, it came from my family. Like, I come from a family of quite fantasy-orientated people, which I kind of didn't realize wasn't, like, I thought everybody was obsessed with Lord of the Rings. And then as I got older, I was like, oh, wait, it's not everyone. It's a lot, but it's not everyone. And I think I just always kind of always been a very bad reader, but have loved stories. So kind of TV and film have been kind of a big part of my life and me kind of understanding my world and stuff. But I think fantasy in particular, like I loved to be transported kind of from the four walls of school. I loved then coming home and thinking about all these magical things and all these possibilities.
Yeah. And so as someone familiar with these stories, what was sort of the hardest learning curve for you as you were preparing to play this role?
The idea of playing someone immortal was something that I thought and talked about kind of endlessly. And kind of something that I ended up sticking with was that, you know, I think we're living in a time at the moment, you know, where we're reckoning with our past and we're learning from our past and we're learning about kind of the consequences of mistakes that were happened before we were born, but that as an elf, she's a kind of like living history. So it was trying to think about what it would feel like to kind of have all the weight of that guilt, not just from the past, but you were there. So that was really fun. In terms of something really challenging also, it was just trying to kind of not get overexcited and overwhelmed. Being on a set of this size and kind of with this many people, and also particularly when you have all these supporting actors in, which sometimes is like 100 people and then a huge crew, like I really hadn't appreciated that every day you were kind of doing a stage show. So that was something that I kind of had to get used to. It's very different to kind of filming something where the whole crew can fit in the living room that your scene's in.
Right, right. And so tell me about filming in New Zealand, because this was pretty early on in COVID, and I assume you all were in sort of a pretty tight bubble for production. But how did that affect you as an actor? Did it have an effect on your experience?
Yeah, so we had a really particular experience in New Zealand that we were in lockdown for quite a very strict lockdown, I think, compared to lots of places, for 6 weeks. And then pretty quickly after that, we started living as normal, but couldn't leave, couldn't go home, because obviously there was a pandemic. And it was very strange to kind of be existing in such, it felt like being on a different planet to the rest of the world. I think the way that it might affected me was just, it kind of, I wanted everyone to be in New Zealand. And I think for all of us, you know, like just the kind of your consciousness kind of exploded outwards once COVID happened. And so I think it incited a love and empathy for the world that I think came out in all our performances, really, because that's what we were thinking about a lot.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
And so, for this role, obviously it has some physically demanding parts to it, and mm-hmm. and also the language. Did you find those aspects difficult, or was that something you enjoyed in the preparation?
I loved the language aspect. Mm-hmm. So I'm Welsh speaking, and when I was first reading The Hobbit, my mum was like super keen to be like, do you know he was obsessed with Welsh, and he based one of the Elvish languages on Welsh, and so kind of that was always something I'd find really exciting about it. And I didn't realize at the time, but I guess I liked reading about bilingual people as well. Do you know these characters that kind of switch between languages? And the way that they wrote the elves was really fun as well, that they kind of created a kind of rhythm to the way they spoke. So there was something kind of quite classical about it that felt almost kind of Shakespearean, which was really fun. Physicality-wise, it was much more frightening. Mm. I've spent a lot of my career being attacked and maimed and wounded and killed. So I'm very good at screaming and being terrified. And obviously Gladriel is not that. And so I was really lucky that I had like a great, I was working with the most amazing stunties who lots of them were in the original films and were in Avatar, you know, done these massive, massive things. And they, it felt like, you know, when people find like a little kitten on the side of the road, it's too scared to come and like talk to them. They kind of like coaxed me out with like little bits. And then eventually I was somehow confident enough to do that stuff on set. But I feel so grateful for like basically re-engaging with teaching. Because I think like lots of actors and lots of people who aren't actors, school wasn't I didn't adore being taught. And I didn't feel like necessarily like a connection with lots of my teachers because I just struggled with like the system. And to kind of be able to kind of be taught by people at my age was wonderful.
I was reading up about how you left school at 16 and sort of found your way to theater. Do you view that as sort of like a turning point in your life, or can you tell me about that time?
Yeah, definitely. I still don't think that, like, even though I think I kind of often get very stressed about things and kind of have done stuff now that kind of really frightens me, I still don't think I've ever been more scared than when I was getting my GCSE results at 16. Like, that felt like it was possibly going to be the end of the world, and like the preparation for it, it just didn't suit me. And I spent my whole school life just in a state of anxiety and disobedience, really, which I guess is also why I would then come home and be like, I need to watch Lord of the Rings. I need to escape. It kind of just made me realize that there was a world beyond school, which it didn't kind of feel like at the time. And that was when I met the people who championed me to actually try and do it. I auditioned for stuff because my mum was sick of me just sitting in the house doing nothing. So I wasn't really chasing it. She was like, you're going to try and audition for this because you can't just hang around and waste your life. And I was like, okay, it's a bit harsh, but yeah. And that kind of started off, just an incredible turn of events that led me somehow to New Zealand. But yeah, Tim Rees-Evans, who was the guy who ran National Youth Opera, has been one of the like biggest people in my life to kind of make me feel that I can do stuff and to be brave and go for it. So yeah, it really was. And I think part of that was meeting adults that I felt kind of safe with as well.
Yeah. After the first season premiered, how are you sort of taking in feedback about the show and the character? I feel like there must be an added level of pressure because this is such an iconic character to the series.
Yeah, definitely. And also because I'm a fan of this type of genre also, like I've read books that have then been turned into things and I've been like, I don't think the house would have looked like that. Do you know, like, I really get it. What's so wonderful about these worlds and these characters is that they don't exist and yet they do so intensely in so many minds. And I think there's kind of an idea of you can't please everyone, but also I do like respect the ownership of her.
Yeah.
Because I know if I was on the other side, I'd also be feeling like that. But I feel very protective about that. I feel lucky to be playing a character that in lots of ways escapes quite a lot of things that like women do. in general because she's physically powerful. And so I feel quite protective of making sure she's like safe from harm.
Yeah. And so the second season moved filming from New Zealand to the UK. Mm-hmm. What has that transition been like for you?
I was very sad to leave New Zealand. I really love that, you know, there's certain kind of awards now that are giving awards to kind of duos or groups, because I do think that a lot of the time, like, it's not a kind of singular individual pursuit. And I felt that so strongly when I was in New Zealand, and I think all of us did who weren't from there, because the crew were not only being incredible with what they were creating for us, but they were also looking after us while we were far from home, while our families were all in lockdown. I'm forever changed by the experience that I had with that crew and kind of the work that I saw them do and what they managed to get me to do. And so I really hope that at some point I go back and kind of feel like I have unfinished business there. Need extra thank yous to be said. But now working in Britain, you know, we have absolutely wonderful people here as well. And it's been wonderful being closer to home. But yeah, I think that one of the greatest things about this career that I found is, like, despite ending up in New Zealand, I don't have a huge amount of wanderlust, but I definitely have it for people. And I have a gift of being able to meet hundreds of people that are working on this. So yeah, I've met double the wonderful people.
And does it feel different filming the second season now that, you know, the first season has been a success and you sort of have that confidence in the project?
The summer before this coming out was wild inside my mind. It was just so frightening and so scary, like not knowing how it'd be received, but also kind of we didn't see it till really late because obviously there needs to be so much care taken with protecting the material and things. It feels good to kind of be coming back to it, just knowing a bit more about the world. Because also it's knowing that you can kind of cope with it as well. Because there was a fear of like how it's going to be received. Like, what if people don't like it? Blah, 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 blah. And then you kind of realize that you're just putting something out there for people to watch and feel however they like about it. And once I kind of relinquished that, it was good. But I feel really lucky. I've kind of had really nice experiences with people who kind of have enjoyed it and quite a lot of kind of young adults enjoying it, which is something that I feel kind of really proud of, really.
Yeah. And what can you, obviously this is like the most secretive show on television, but what can you say about where your characters goes this season after the events that transpired at the end of the first season?
I just have to take a deep breath before I do this because
what am I allowed to say?
Yeah, panic. So last season, I think that she was, her grief was so intense, her sadness was so huge. And I think kind of when you're in those points of like ultimate lows, you do end up becoming self-obsessed because you can't see anything beyond this kind of haze of misery. And now that's started to clear. And hopefully with that, she's rediscovering kind of the beauty of life and what she was really trying to protect the whole time beyond herself. And that's something I just love about Tolkien. You know, you need to be connected to the world and those around you. And I think that was what her great sadness truly was in the first season, that she had isolated herself. And no one can thrive that way.
And we're almost out of time, but I am curious how playing this character or going through this experience has sort of influenced what you're looking for in your career.
I think that variation is just the biggest thing. Like, I do think I'm getting my fix of the giant stuff. And kind of, so when I was filming Lord of the Rings, I kind of, towards the end, I was just like, I'd love to do a studio play with like 10 people in the audience. And I still kind of love that. But yeah, I think it's variation. But I do need to get back on stage soon or I will never be brave enough to do it again. But yeah, I think I've been so lucky to manage to get this job that gives me a fix of like working in massive sets, wearing kind of clothes that you could wear to the Met Gala.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular roundtable conversations. You can find us at vanityfair.com, on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider, and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.